WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This year marks the 250th anniversary of the publication of Samuel Johnson's Dictionary, the first great dictionary of the English language. Nowadays, most of us think of dictionaries as an accepted part of our culture, but as our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out, in recent years there's been a heated controversy over the use of dictionaries in the legal world.
In an age when anxiety about the language is usually relegated to Sunday supplement features and the perky titles in the language ghetto at the back of the bookstore, it's hard for us to understand why Samuel Johnson's dictionary had such a serious political importance when it was first published in 1755. The dictionary appeared at the moment when public opinion, shaped by the press and literature, was becoming a social force to reckon with, challenging the authority of traditional institutions like the monarchy, the church, and parliament. But how could you count on printed words to determine common values when they seemed to change their meaning from one speaker to another or from one generation to the next? As William Warburton wrote in 1747, "We have neither grammar nor dictionary, neither chart nor compass to guide us through this wide sea of words." The publication of Johnson's dictionary instantly allayed those anxieties. It seemed to capture the elusive and fluttering meanings of words and pin their wings to its pages. By the modern age, dictionaries would be largely ceremonial fixtures of public life, honored with inattentive piety. We refer to dictionaries as if there were only one of them. We talk about the dictionary the way we talk about the periodic table, as if it were merely a clear window on the truth of words. That's a harmless illusion for people who turn to dictionaries only to get a general idea of the meaning of a word like vilify or plangent. But the illusion starts to fray when you try to use a short dictionary definition to sort out the marginal cases and fine shades of meaning that courts often have to resolve. For most of its existence, in fact, the Supreme Court rarely referred to dictionaries to determine the meanings of the words of the statutes it was considering. Justices Holmes, Brandeis, and Cardozo didn't once cite a dictionary in all their years on the court. It's only recently that the use of dictionaries has become a routine practice. Since 1990, the court has referred to dictionary definitions in more cases than in the preceding two centuries of its life. The main reason for that shift is the rise of the legal doctrine called textualism. When courts are trying to determine the meaning of a statute or regulation, the doctrine says, they should look only at the plain meanings of the words of the text itself, not at the intentions of Congress or the legislative history of the law. And where better to look than in the neutral source that most people turn to settle disputes over meaning? So it's no accident that the justice who's referred to dictionaries most often is Antonin Scalia, the most eloquent advocate of textualism. He's followed by Clarence Thomas, though to judge from Samuel Alito's penchant for citing dictionaries in his decisions, he might give both of them a run for their money. But using a dictionary to determine the meanings of words turns out to be not quite the automatic or neutral procedure that most of us take it to be. Some dictionaries define words more broadly than others. And when a dictionary gives several meanings for a word, judges have a lot of discretion in deciding which of them is most appropriate. In one 1993 case, for example, the Supreme Court ruled that a man who traded a rifle for some cocaine could be sentenced under a statute that provided for an increased penalty for someone who uses a firearm to obtain narcotics. Writing for the majority, Justice O'Connor justified the decision by citing one dictionary's definition of use as to employ. To his credit, Justice Scalia dissented, following a rule of interpretation that you could paraphrase as "give me a break." In ordinary usage, he said, using a firearm means using it as a weapon, not as a medium of barter. But Scalia himself hasn't been above what some have called dictionary shopping. Does the word representatives, as used in the 1982 Voting Rights Act, apply to elected judges in addition to legislators? In a 1991 decision, Scalia said it didn't. He cited the definition of the word in the 1934 Webster's Second, a dictionary that language traditionalists regard with the same kind of reverence that folk purists have for Bob Dylan's acoustic era. But if he'd wanted to argue the other way, Scalia could have referred to the broader definitions of representative in the more recent Webster's Third or the American Heritage, both of which he has found it convenient to cite on other occasions. But the most dramatic recent example of the selective use of dictionaries comes not from a Supreme Court decision, but from the Memorandum on Torture that was written for the Justice Department in 2002 by Assistant Attorney General Jay Bybee, who's since been appointed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. By cherry-picking his dictionaries and definitions, Bybee managed to come up with a definition of torture that ruled out any practice that doesn't cause lasting impairment or inflict pain that rises to the level of death or organ damage. By that standard, nothing that happened at Abu Ghraib would count as torture, even if most people would describe it that way. Bybee's definition winds up being a far cry from the plain meaning of the word, but the appeal to a dictionary seems to cloak it in Johnsonian rectitude. Johnson himself approached his project with more humility than that. He knew that no dictionary could regiment what he called the boundless chaos of a living speech and reduce it to mechanical certainty. And there's no greater insult to his memory than to imagine now that that's a done deal.
Linguist Jeff Nunberg teaches at the University of California at Berkeley School of Information and is the author of the book Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times.